Recording and Performance Studios. You can make a difference. Visit CFRC.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt through Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. More information at CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic, every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
So this is our panel on addressing ecological risks, and we're going to start off with Lindsay Burrows. Then we're going to have Arden, who's going to speak to us about psychologically informed climate institutions. And then we're going to have Sophie Thériault, who's going to talk to us about green colonialism at the critical minerals frontier.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Elise. I feel like that could be a TED Talk. You could really hit the road with that presentation. It was, I think for all of us in here, none of us being civil engineers, that really gave us a lot to think about it in a way that was really accessible and digestible. And I am grateful too because of the focus of my presentation here is thinking about Indigenous legal institutions and responses to climate change in Canada. So a lot of this morning's conversation has focused importantly on colonial legal institutions, both in Canada and the United States, and the ways that they are trying to respond and create patterns and pathways through this challenge of our time. And the argument, broadly speaking, that I'll be making is that Indigenous peoples' own legal institutions and legal orders are similarly operating in both Canada, the United States, globally as well, although I'll be focusing on Canada. And so to begin, I brought in with me here this dish with one spoon wampum belt. So this was talked about earlier today. And this law was negotiated in the 1500s by members of the Anishinaabe Nation and the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And the lands through which it connected to are here along the shores of Lake Huron, heading east to the St. Lawrence River. And what was happening here is often these types of wampum agreements came forward because of either a conflict that was already taking place or a recognition that a potential conflict was about to come forward. And with these two very different cultures, legal orders, sharing overlapping territories, they saw the need to come up with a way to get along with one another. And so the dish, which is the purple beads in the middle, represents the territory, the lands, the waters. And then the white beads in the middle is a spoon. And the idea here is that there are soft edges on that tool from which we take from the land, and that we don't want to have the pokiness of some other implements that we could be using to eat. And it's when we have that kind of gentleness and the softness and that recognition of this as a shared territory that is finite, that has its natural limits, that we can then come to live in greater harmony with one another. So I'll pass this around for a little show and tell. But part of why I wanted to open with this too is we can think, well, where was the legal institution in creating this? Where was the parliament? Where were the courts? Where was the legislature? And so, of course, when we're thinking about Indigenous legal orders, certainly historically, those kind of institutional settings looked very different from how we see often Western law being portrayed today. And importantly, Indigenous legal orders today are taking up, in some instances, like similar institutional expressions of how to engage in decision making. In the United States, for example, there's a strong presence of tribal courts. In Canada, that hasn't been taken up as much as an option, or as an opportunity. So what I want to share over the next kind of 7 minutes now is five different examples. Oh, that's okay. It doesn't matter. Five different examples that I think are quite interesting that are being implemented by Indigenous peoples' own kind of governance institutions that are having an impact on the landscape of ecological governance in Canada, which I argue is greatly influencing climate response. So one kind of opening word too before I share those five examples, which might end up being two examples, is there in Canada, we're thinking about First Nations, Inuit, and Métis as kind of like the divisions that we talk about when thinking through Indigenous laws. And a question from a skeptic might be, well, really, how are First Nations impacting climate law in Canada when it's approximately 1 million people in a country of 40 million, and they hold formally about 6% of Canada's land mass? And then on the other side, looking up to the Inuit, it's less than 1% of the population, much less, it's 65,000 people. Yet they own, through the Inuit Taparit, which is organized into like four different Inuit kind of advocacy organizations. They formally own and co-manage almost 45% of Canada's landmass in the north, which we've just learned is such a critical area for climate response, adaptation, mitigation, research, etc. So here we have Natan Obed, the president of ITK, who is kind of the president of half of Canada. And they have this incredible National Inuit Climate Strategy document, which was released a few years ago, that outlines what they view as their obligations as people who have lived in relationship with those lands and waters for generations and generations. And so it's drawing on, again, that traditional ecological knowledge and putting it into conversation as they see appropriate with modern kind of scientific research. So I think that while the numbers are small in terms of population, the landmass is significant. And I think anyone who's worked in kind of extractive industries would really view First Nations as kind of mosquitoes that they're trying to always swat away as they're engaging in these projects and trying to figure out, like, where is the certainty here and how we can engage in this? And because of the huge diversity of Indigenous peoples too, it's not like your negotiation with the Blackfoot is going to be the same as with the Mi'kmaq or the Tsilhqot'in. And so it's bringing up this really kind of dynamic environment as we think about climate response. And it's not one that is harmonized across the country because of that great diversity. So the first thing that I think is exciting that I'm seeing is contemporary Indigenous constitution writing. So these constitutional orders used to not be written down in textual ways, but increasingly so they are. And this summer I did some research on how is the more than human being approached in these contemporary Indigenous constitutions. And it was fascinating to see how across the board and the diversity of legal orders, they're often writing about kind of the rights of the crawling ones, the winged ones, the finned ones, and including them as citizenries within the Constitution. They're drawing on the language from the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and talking about The importance of kind of environmental decision making, their creation stories. They have language around the seven generations. There's language about thinking about the ways that their ancestors lived in relationship with the earth. And I think it's significant that this is being put into these constitutions because the laws, the positivistic laws that then flow from that, are necessarily going to try and find ways to give life or meaning to those kind of foundational constitutional principles. So that's one. Another exciting area, how I think Indigenous legal institutions are impacting climate responses through Indigenous protected and conserved areas. And so these IPCAs, as they're called, are really being taken up by the federal government in Canada as a way to achieve their 30 by 30 goal, that is 30% of Canada's landmass protected in some way by 2030. And they're providing a lot of money, relatively speaking, for Indigenous communities to be the ones to institute these IPCAs so that they can be doing their work in this biodiversity efforts. And I read an interesting paper recently, whose authors I don't remember, but many co-authors, about how the areas across the globe that have the highest levels of biodiversity correspond with areas of linguistic diversity, often with Indigenous populations and what the authors call local populations. So again, even though this is relatively speaking like these smaller pockets of people, I think there's kind of a yeast-like effect where this tiny bit goes in, and yet it has this strong, powerful rising capacity. Another exciting area is in contemporary treaty making. So in 2014, a number of First Nations on both the Canadian and U.S. side of the border got together to negotiate a Buffalo Treaty. And this was in kind of Alberta, Montana. And the idea here was to create the habitat restoration that was necessary in order to bring about to revitalize these bison populations. And that has significance both ecologically, but also culturally and for those different nations coming together both as Indigenous peoples, but also as citizens of the United States and citizens of Canada too, as many of them recognize that kind of dual citizenry. And through those, there's also conversations right now around doing a similar thing with salmon in the Pacific Northwest, having like a salmon treaty negotiated that would be between tribes and across borders that would have to take into account all of these issues of habitat and interjurisdictional laws as well. And then finally, I'll just make a note on the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples too, because so with these examples, we see nations passing constitutions, which is for their own nation. The treaties are them kind of coming together in a multi-jurisdictional way. Then we have the IPCAs, which are in a localized into a particular place, but have impacts on the provinces where they're created. And then UNDRIP, we have this piece of federal legislation now where all legislation in Canada is supposed to be in line with the principles and the spirit of UNDRIP. And that's going to, I think, have an interesting impact as we think through how do we do that? And what's going to flow? What kinds of arguments are suddenly going to be more persuasive because of that legal regime? And then Indigenous peoples are really showing up in a strong way in the international forum, going to things like the Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Peoples in New York, reaching out to the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. All these different international law forums kind of provide like a storytelling mechanism, I think, to bring people together in unique ways and do that collaborative work that's necessary to move from the local up to a broader scale to kind of harmonize and coordinate the patterns that they see as important. So I think that's my 15-minute time there. So thanks so much for listening. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. First, thanks so much to Cherie for pulling this together. It's so fun to have such an interesting group talking about such an important set of issues, and I'm really happy that I can be here. So I'm Arden Rowell, rhymes with garden trowel, if you're struggling with the last name. And I'm going to be talking about building psychologically informed climate institutions, why it's important, and some ideas about what we could do to at least start accomplishing it. So here's the overarching kind of thesis of the talk, which is that I think to be effective, climate institutions need to recognize and meaningfully grapple with the psychology of climate harms. And I believe that some of the reason that some institutions have failed to be effective in the past can be traced to a failure to understand the psychology of climate harms, a failure to understand how people perceive and think about the harms of climate change. And so I'll try to convince you of that by the end of the talk today. So here's how I'm going to do that, hopefully. So first, I'm just going to talk a bit about the psychology of climate harms, what it is that makes climate harms so difficult for people to perceive, to understand, and to value. And I'll talk about what that means for climate institutions, at least in my view, and then hopefully we'll get to some payoffs and implications. All right, so I wrote a book about this this first point, which is that environmental harms in general, and this includes now not just climate change, but also pollution harms and harms from ecosystem degradation as well. Environmental harms are generally psychologically difficult for people to perceive, understand, and value. And that's because of specific characteristics of environmental injury. That is the fact that environmental injuries like climate tend to be diffuse across space and time. That makes it really hard for people to perceive those harms. It's come up several times already today. Distant harms that are far away are hard to visualize. Distant harms that are far away in time also trigger their own set, or their own constellation of cognitive phenomena that lead people to discount them. In addition, environmental harms are complex. That is, they're multi-causal, they're interactive, and they often involve non-linear relationships. All of those are things that people struggle to process cognitively, and which we therefore have come up with a series of simplifying heuristics to manage. But when you have a legitimately difficult system, like the environment in which a phenomenon are occurring, and you apply an overly simplified model, you end up with mistakes. And so that's what happens to people when they try to process complex environmental harms. And then finally, and this also touches on something that Lindsay was just saying, people struggle to process harms that are non-human in character. So this is essentially happens because our brains developed to be social brains, to understand other humans. So huge portions of our brains are devoted to thinking and processing emotional input that comes from other people. And that's why we do things like, for example, look at pieces of toast and see faces in them. Our brains, our social brains, are actually imposing humanity on things that are non-human. When things are non-human to begin with, though, we struggle. So anyway, so there's a book, I think too long of a book about this, that I wrote with Kenworthy Bills. One of the authors of this book thought it was too long. I won't tell you which one it was. I already did tell you. Ah, I gave it away. No, okay. Well, it was me. Okay, but a portion of it, maybe too little of it, talks about climate harms. And so here, all of these problems that I just mentioned also apply when it comes to climate harm. But in addition, there's some more things that make climate harms even harder. Here's two of them. One, climate harms are obviously global in character, and that means and they trigger, in many cases, concerns of extreme magnitude impacts. Extreme magnitude impacts, snowball Earth or something. These are things that humans don't have experience with, and so our heuristic systems of thinking are sort of cognition, etc., are not designed to deal with that kind of problem. And in addition, many of the harms of climate change are foreign, and that triggers a series of concerns having to do with basically in-group, out-group bias and sort of other problems that make this even harder. Okay, so let me give you a couple of examples of how this plays out. I'm going to go very quickly through this one. One way that this plays out is that we see difficulty in people processing and thinking about extreme scenarios. That is, anything that hasn't come up before and anything that isn't immediately visualizable. And so we see this problem arising not just in climate change context, but also in a number of other extreme scenario contexts, like contact with extraterrestrials or the management of artificial general intelligence. But basically, it leads to people entirely discounting low probability but high magnitude events in a way that doesn't necessarily make sense, given even their expected value, but which is poses a number of challenges in trying to address. And then an additional aspect of extreme scenarios is that is a kind of emotional factor, which is when people are presented with large amounts of depressing information, they often will basically trigger psychic numbing. They'll just turn off as a kind of coping mechanism to not get too depressed. And so we see if you give people too much information about genocides, for example, after a while, they start to become numbed. And of course, the same thing can happen when it comes to trying to communicate about some of the worst impacts of climate change. Anyway, I know I'm going pretty quickly here through this part, but that's because here's what I really want to spend a chunk of time talking about, which is another example of a phenomenon that I think really importantly impacts the perception of climate harm, and which I don't see legal institutions effectively addressing, is the phenomenon of moral disengagement. So moral disengagement was most prominently explored by psychologist Albert Bandura, who wrote this fabulous book called Moral Disengagement, How Good People Can Do Harm and Feel Good About Themselves. And so it's an explanation of how we end up with things, again, like genocide, but it also applies, I think, very importantly to how we end up with the situation in climate change that we have right now. And so it basically involves a process of people convincing themselves that ethical standards that they might hold in other circumstances don't apply to them in a particular context. That is, for example, that they have not actually harmed people that they have harmed, or that the harm that they've caused is not so bad. And there are sort of a bunch of different kind of techniques that people use, largely subconsciously, to accomplish this, to avoid the pain of feeling that they've caused harm to others. And Bandura and now others have gone through and sort of categorized these, researched each of these. And each of them, I think we can see quite clearly in the climate context across multiple, both in the institutional context and also in the individual context. But I'll give you a kind of sampling of the kinds of techniques that this leads to. And again, the purpose of all of these, or purpose may be the wrong word, the impact of all of these is to basically mute the pain that otherwise good people might feel at the thought of causing harm, because good people don't want to hurt other people. Good people don't want to do bad things. And so how do you avoid feeling that hurt? You either didn't cause the harm, you press on the causation point, or it wasn't actually harmful. Right? And so each of these strategies works on some aspect of that. So one strategy is moral justification. That's basically where you explain that, yes, sure, climate change is happening, but we really need to have this level of emission so that we can promote development and avoid hunger, et cetera. Another is euphemistic labeling, where you minimize the apparent harm by, for example, talking about weather as opposed to climate, talking about bad weather days. A third is an advantageous comparison. So this is trying to make the harm that you cause look less bad by pointing to other people who did more harm, right? So we see this way too often, of course, in the climate context. But for example, countries wrangling over who's the greatest emitter and under along what standard. Same thing with displacing and diffusing responsibility. So everybody pointing to somebody else as the cause of the problem, another way of kind of muting this harm, this pain that otherwise people and people within institutions may feel. And then finally, dehumanizing victims or minimizing the hurt that is caused to them. Maybe a version of this is also suggesting that that the harms that are going to be experienced are not going to be so terrible. Note, however, the sixth one there, dehumanizing victims, it's already it's suggesting that you're going to feel less about victims that are non-human, which, of course, many of the victims of climate change are non-human to begin with. So it's an interesting intersection there. All right. So what can we do about any of that? And what does that have to do with institutions? And so one of the reasons I wanted to talk about one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this particular phenomenon to begin with is that there's research that suggests that this is reasonably fixable in response to awareness. So if you learn that moral disengagement is a thing, and you start to recognize and are taught to recognize some of these key strategies, or again, strategy, possibly not the right term given the subconscious nature of it, but these key mechanisms or routes that people use to morally disengage, then pretty good evidence suggests that that your moral disengagement will decrease. And my favorite intervention showing this was one where the person running the study was teaching ninth graders about this phenomenon. And what she did is every time that one of their classmates used one of these mechanisms, she would have them hold up a sign that said "pirate excuse," and doing that and having that kind of salient intervention meant that they were able to significantly reduce moral disengagement and also just to become more aware of it in general. So it's not always going to be a remedy in psychological contexts to merely be aware of a bias. Some biases are very resistant to debiasing. But this is one where there's at least some evidence suggesting that awareness alone may be helpful. There's some critical thinking interventions that can be done as well, as some research suggesting that starting conversations or negotiations by reaffirming and emphasizing core shared values, like none of us here want to hurt anyone, all of us here care about the environment, even very basic things like that, it can help avoid getting in a situation where negotiations stall because of moral disengagement, or we end up with widely varying views of what's happening. Okay, so what does it all have to do with climate institutions? So I think the main thing that has to do with climate institutions is that climate change harms, climate harms, are extremely obscure and extremely difficult for individuals to think about, identify, manage on their own. And more so even than environmental harms generally, which are already really hard. So that puts additional pressure on legal and non-market solutions. That means that market-based solutions in particular, this won't come as a surprise to anyone in the room, may be insufficient to address climate change, but it gives us a different way of thinking about why that is. And it also gives us a set of challenges that we have to recognize so that if we're going to build institutions to respond to that, our institutions are taking account of those same challenges. So that's what I think should happen. That's not what's necessarily happened so far. Many climate institutions, and particularly international institutions, continue to rely on what I would view as a simplistic model of decision-making. And I think that's problematic. So here I'll give a very quick super quick orientation into different modes of decision making, and then my own gloss on what it is that we tend to see in climate institutions when it comes to models of decision making. But basically speaking, if we're asking how individuals make decisions, there are at least two different models that we might use to try to answer that question. One is rational choice theory, which is a simplified model. It's a theoretical model, non-empirical model, where we assume that individuals are going to make decisions that maximize their own self-interest. And obviously, it has a long history in law and economics in particular. Another kind of approach, and you could call an empirical approach, you can call it a psychological approach, a behavioral approach. But basically, you could try to answer the question of how people make decisions by looking to empirical research rather than coming up with a simplified theoretical model. And now I have a strong preference myself about which of these models I'm going to use, even though, which is just to give this away, the second one. But that said, I understand that a rational choice theory can have some simplifying benefits and in some cases can be useful. However, I think one thing we really need to recognize when it comes to climate institutions is that this move of just replacing individuals with states and then transferring our models over wholesale is potentially problematic. It's likely to be at least incomplete. And it's what's happening now, and it's happening now in a world where it's mostly actually rational choice theory that's being transferred over. Right? So this is a double mistake in my view. It's replacing states with individuals in a kind of weird, monstrous sense, right? And there may be important differences in decision-making between these two beasts. And it's transferring over theories of individual decision-making from rational choice theory instead of an empirically based set of expectations about individual decisions, which would at least be more accurate when it comes to the individual decisions, right? So I think there are multiple problems going on with current expectations within climate institutions about what it is, how it is that people are making decisions. Both of those likely need to be addressed. I think this question of how do you deal with, you know, state decision-making versus individual is very hard, and I don't know what the right answer, I don't know how you should figure this out. I don't think anybody else knows right now either, although I think that that would be a fruitful area for research. What I think can be done now, though, is that we can enrich our understanding of decision-making, at least by individuals, including individuals who work within states, to be based on empirical research and reflecting the best state of our knowledge, rather than thoughtlessly continuing to accept a rational choice assumption. So let me give you an example about how it is that that shift, at least that one shift from thinking about decision making in rational choice contexts versus a kind of empirically informed approach, it could help us in thinking about some of the problems that have been intractable or very difficult when it comes to managing climate change. So here's my first example, which is take this observation that the greatest historical emitters, the United States, have really resisted even being characterized as having been the historically greatest emitters. Why is that? Is that the U.S. being strategic and trying to like pull one over on people, right? Or is it the U.S. just sincerely, you could say, misperceiving the harm that they have caused, right? Is this a world where we have a bad actor who's trying to trick us, or is it a world where maybe even a laudable sense of not wanting to feel like you've hurt someone leads you to misperceive what's going on? Which of these accounts you have of why it is that there's a reluctance to sort of take ownership of a harm can have important consequences both in negotiations and also in how it is that we develop safeguards and responses from there. In general, you could just say polluters often underestimate the externalities of their actions. Is that because they're strategic? Could be, of course, but is it merely because they're strategic? Well, I mean, the research on moral disengagement suggests that even if they're not strategic, they're likely to sincerely underperceive the effects of their actions, right? And so what we're dealing with is a whole bunch of people and institutions who are sincerely underperceiving. That's a different world and one I think we need to recognize and incorporate into our institutional structures and then one where everybody is greedy and trying to trick everyone else. Same thing when it comes to individual decision-making. So why can it be so difficult to get some individuals to recognize their participation in or even the existence of climate harms? Is it because they're being shifty or is it because it's very hard to realize that you are the cause of something terrible? And again, the more that we think, whichever of these is going on, we should probably develop different institutional responses. And since I think it is often the case that at least part of what's going on is a sincere misperception, that's what I'd like to see. That's what I'd like to see focused on in climate institutions in the future. I think even if we just take moral disengagement as an example of how it is that incorporating more empirical and behavioral assumptions about decision making into climate institutions might be helpful, I think we can get some pretty significant payoffs. I mean, especially given that this is not really that large of a shift. One is that the more that you think about the other people sitting around a table as people who are good people who don't want to hurt other people, rather than people who are trying to trick you, the more a trust may be built. And so we could have some benefits there. Could have increased improvements in communication, not only across decision makers and policymakers, but also with the public, if we have better models for understanding how it is that people perceive and make decisions and more effective policy overall. And there's a couple of different strategies we could use to potentially achieve that. But let me just wrap up by coming back to what my main point was, which I hope I have convinced you of, which is I think to be effective, climate institutions need to recognize and grapple with the psychology of climate harms, and that doing so offers some opportunities for improving the effectiveness of climate law and policy. Thanks.
I tentatively entitled this paper, which is still very much a work in progress, I should say, Green Colonialism at the Critical Mineral Frontiers Towards a Just Energy Transition for Indigenous Peoples. The idea from this research came out from a highly mediatized conflict that recently opposed the Innu of Washak Makmenutnam to a junior mining company, Murchison Minerals, specializing in the exploration of minerals such as nickel and cobalt used in green energy technology. So shortly in August 2023, just a few weeks after I'd left the community of Washat, where I'd heard a lot about the importance of the land for the Innu, Murchison Minerals left its exploration camp south of Fermont, Quebec, in the territory known by the Innu as Nitassinan, after more than a year of pressure from the community. While Murchison Minerals described its activities as essential to the quickly evolving clean energy revolution, the community seeks to protect this part of Nitassinan, which is intensely used by the Innu for traditional activities, as well as for the transmission of culture and knowledge. In opposing Murchison Minerals' exploration plan, the community asserted its territorial rights over Nitassinan, its lack of consent to the project, and its responsibility to protect the most sensitive areas of its territories from industrial development. Such conflicts, and I could have used other examples actually, are likely to multiply in the coming years as the energy transition accelerates in response to the climate crisis, and with it, the global demand for critical minerals. While critical minerals are needed to build the renewable energy infrastructure required to decarbonize our energy systems, the risks and benefits associated with extractive industries are not distributed equitably across territories and communities. In particular, the intensification of mining activities places increasing pressure on indigenous peoples, adding to the legacy of past and ongoing industrial activities on these same territories, a dynamics that some scholars and grassroots organizations have termed green colonialism or green extractivism. My paper uses a climate and environmental justice perspective to examine the implications of dominant energy transition and critical minerals discourses for Indigenous peoples and their rights in the Canadian context. I argue that while renewable energy technologies and infrastructure are necessary to decarbonize our economies and mitigate the impacts of climate change, the ever-increasing demand for critical minerals and the discourses used to justify it risk reinforcing pre-existing settler colonial processes of dispossession. Therefore, a just energy transition should efficiently respond to the climate crisis, yet in a way that promotes the territorial rights and self-determination of Indigenous peoples according to their own legal orders and conceptions of environmental justice. So the first part of this research project consists in analyzing the policy and industry discourses about critical minerals in Canada. So just a few words on what are the so-called critical minerals, which is not easy to capture since minerals that are considered critical may vary from country to country and also over time depending on multiple factors that I won't discuss today. The Canadian government, for its part, considers a mineral to be critical if it is essential to Canada's energy security, required for our transition to a low carbon economy, or if it is a source of strategic minerals for our partners and allies. Like, according to those criteria, Canada has identified 31 critical minerals, six of them receiving priority status, that is lithium, graphite, nickel, cobalt, copper, and rare earth elements. So this list of critical minerals, as well as others in provinces and territories, were elaborated with the adoption of the critical mineral strategies that emerge in the past few years at the federal level, but also in many provinces and territories. The first one being the one adopted by the government of Quebec in 2020, and the last one adopted just a few weeks ago by Newfoundland and Labrador. So these critical mineral strategies aim to stimulate investment and accelerate the development of critical minerals. And it is this material that I am analyzing as part as this research project. So according to this early analysis of those policies, these public policies justify the urgency of discovering, extracting, and transforming critical minerals on the basis of essentially three lines of argument. So the first line of argument emphasizes the vital role of critical minerals in the transition to a net zero emission economy and fight against climate change. This is found in the different strategies, very strongly in the federal one that I'm quoting here. We find phrases such as, without critical minerals, there can be no energy transition for Canada and the world. So critical minerals are an essential part of climate change, fighting climate change. The second line of argument emphasizes the imperative to secure the supply chains of critical minerals for Canada and its allies. We find this discourse very strongly in the federal strategy, but also in some others, including the Ontario strategy. So Canada is depicted as a secure and reliable supplier or a safe jurisdiction to provide itself, but also the world with critical minerals. And finally, taking, which is central, in fact, to all critical mineral strategies across the country, is this generational opportunity presented by critical minerals for economic growth and prosperity. So this is really a transversal theme that is like very present, in fact, at the core of the critical mineral strategies. And here I will quote the slogan that opens the Quebec critical mineral strategy that captures it very well. Let's advance the energy transition, which is essential to the fight against climate change. Let's create wealth by adding value to our critical and strategic minerals. It is also stronger than me to quote here former premier of Manitoba, who, when launching Manitoba's critical mineral strategy last July, said, declared that Manitoba is like the Costco of critical minerals. If you need it, we have it, which shows very well the primarily like economic incentive behind the government's will to develop critical minerals. Similar line of discourses are found in the industry. I won't go through it in details, but I'm quoting here the Canadian Mining Association of Canada in a recent document in 2023. Mining is essential to the global energy transition. Climate change is the critical issue facing the globe over the next century. Minerals and metals will help the world transition to a low carbon future. And we find similar discourses on the website of mining companies and mining organizations that present, in fact, the mining industry as a sort of climate savior. These discourses translates in concrete measures and actions that will lead in an acceleration of mining activities in the country, including massive public and private investments to stimulate exploration and accelerate production of critical minerals, and also a pressure that has been observed, in fact, around the world to fast-track extractive projects and to streamline regulatory approval processes to accelerate the development of critical minerals. So overall, the dominant approach to the energy transition, while invoking ideas of transformation, innovation, and sustainability, is largely grounded in the settler colonial extractivist logics, culture, and power structure that produced the climate crisis in the first place. These logics, I argue, could further exacerbate the dispossession of indigenous peoples have experienced and that they continue experiencing as a result of past and present extractive activities under traditional lands. Renewable energy triumphalism, to borrow the expression from Therese Ackermars, emphasizes the global benefits of the energy transition, while largely obscuring the more localized environmental, social, and cultural impacts of the extractive activities associated with green technology. The energy transition thus creates its own sacrifice zones, a term used in the environmental justice movement and literature that some scholars have recently reframed as green sacrifice zones to include places and populations that will be disproportionately affected by the solutions to transition to a low carbon economy, such as critical mineral development. In Canada, as clearly emphasized in the Canadian Critical Mineral Strategy, the majority of current and future critical mineral projects are located on or near the traditional territories of Indigenous people, who will bear a disproportionate burden of the socio-ecological impacts of the extractive activities and infrastructure associated with the energy transition. So I won't go in details into it, but the mining life cycle, it is quite well documented. From early exploration to mine closure and rehabilitation can have considerable socio-ecological impacts on indigenous communities. It is also important to emphasize that for many indigenous peoples, these impacts occur in the backdrop of the legacy of past and present industrial development on their traditional lands, including the flooding of vast areas by hydroelectric dams, massive deforestation, and the thousands of orphaned and abandoned mining sites across the country. As you can see from the picture here, some sites dating from multiple decades, but some sites recently found, including some in Nunavik exploration site in Nunavik, that were found this summer abandoned, which shows that there are reason to fear that the increasing mining activities could have a very negative impact on the land, and that some practice have yet to fully change. These impacts are also adding to the socio-ecological cumulative impacts of climate change on Indigenous peoples' homeland and livelihood. So Indigenous peoples who contribute only marginally to greenhouse gas emissions are also disproportionately affected by climate change, especially in the north, as shown eloquently by Liz DeVoy's presentation, with ice and permafrost melting and significant changes in ecosystems and biodiversity, which are exerting an ever-increasing pressure on Indigenous people's traditional activities and food systems, among other impacts. So these observations lead me to reflect on the pathways to a just energy transition for Indigenous peoples. The recognition and protection of Indigenous peoples' inherent right to land and resources, to self-determination, and to consultation and free, prior, and informed consent are widely seen as necessary conditions for achieving greater justice for Indigenous peoples in the context of extractive development. These rights are enshrined in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I'm showing here two key provisions of this declaration, Article 3, on the right to self-determination, which, according to the literature, involves the capacity for Indigenous peoples to control their own destinies, including in relation to their traditional territories, land, and resources. Control that is exercised in part by the principle of free, prior, and informed consent. I won't read it here, but I'm quoting Article 32, Paragraph 2 of the Declaration that provides for the consultation, the obligation of government to consult in order to obtain Indigenous peoples' consent prior to the approval of a project affecting their lands or territories and other resources. I should mention here that the government of Canada and of British Columbia have both formally committed to take all measures necessary to ensure that the law of Canada and British Columbia are consistent with the declaration by adopting statutes to implement it in their respective legal orders. The meaning of the right to self-determination and free, prior, and informed consent are subject to debates in the literature, debates that turn very often around free, prior, informed consent as a process versus free, prior, and informed consent as a veto, debates that are still ongoing. And while they are ongoing on an everyday basis, Indigenous peoples enact their inherent jurisdiction in their homelands in accordance with their own legal and political orders, as I illustrated at the beginning of this presentation with the case of Wahchap, Mac, Mani, Utnam. I propose in this project that instead of continuing these argumentation between efficace process, efficace veto, we may find the meaning of self-determination and free prior and informed consent in the context of mining in indigenous laws and practices, including in indigenous constitutions, consultation and consent protocols, mining policies, and indigenous-led impact assessment processes, among other expression of indigenous legal orders. This project, however, faces at the moment structural, important structural obstacles that are coming from the critical mineral strategies in the country, but also in the way Canada and the provinces and territories conduct their relationship with indigenous peoples. For instance, Canadian critical mineral strategies are really focused when they talk about Indigenous peoples on the procedural duty to consult and accommodate, and on terms such as economic reconciliation and depicting Indigenous peoples mainly as stakeholders or as partners of the extractive industries. So in short, even if Indigenous peoples do participate effectively in mining, they are assumed through these policies as desiring mining development on their traditional lands, an assumption that can be quite problematic. I should mention, however, that the federal strategies do contain quite extensive references to the UN Declaration as well as the UN Declaration Act. However, it should be emphasized that mining is primarily under provincial jurisdiction. So the federal strategy may not echo at many stages in relation to many mining projects, especially that there's a very high threshold for federal impact assessment for mining projects. And we still need to see the impact on this of the recent reference on the Impact Assessment Act that may perhaps reduce the scope of federal impact assessment in the country. I would also mention the pressure to fast-track critical mineral project that is antithetical to the principles of free prior informed consent, as well as to the principle of reconciliation. And finally, the paper will address the issue of the colonial mining legal frameworks that are still in place in most provinces and territories that are based on free entry, what we call free entry mining, and systems of mining claims that are structured in such a way that prevent any consultation prior to the acquisition of mining claims on Indigenous people's lands, and that are leading mining proponents to conduct some exploration activities even without consulting Indigenous peoples who are for whom it is a homeland. I will mention here, without discussing them, that there are several cases, one recently decided by the British Supreme Court, one that has been recently heard by the Quebec Superior Court, and a former from Yukon, in which free entry mining systems have been constitutionally challenged under Section 35 of the Constitution Act with some level of success. For instance, British Columbia has 18 months to provide for consultation prior to the acquisition of mining claims on Indigenous people's lands. But as it is, these legal frameworks are prioritizing mining over other land uses and will play a role in helping to accelerate mining in the context of the energy transition. So a few concluding thoughts. First, to recognize that decarbonizing the energy systems can promote climate justice for Indigenous peoples who are disproportionately affected by climate change and who can benefit from renewable energy projects and from mining development under certain conditions. So it's not to say that all those minerals should necessarily stay underground should not be used for the energy transition, which is necessary. However, the infrastructure and technologies on which the dominant approach to energy transition is based require intensive and extensive levels of extraction that can exacerbate environmental injustices and the historical dispossession of indigenous peoples. So to capture it through the words of researchers Dana Scott and Adrian Smith, climate justice requires considerations not only of whether to tackle climate justice by transitioning from a fossil fuel economy, but more profoundly of how to undertake that transition, bearing in mind the distributional effects related to renewable energy transition. Thinking the energy transition more sustainably could be done through the lens of indigenous environmental justice. I mentioned the work of MacGregor, Todd, Kyle White, which means that we should understand the close link between environmental degradation and settler processes of land dispossession, center indigenous ontologies, pedagogies, knowledge, relationships, experience, and legal orders in thinking about solutions to both climate change and energy transition, and enact indigenous peoples' self-determination and sovereignty. I will conclude with these words from Nikki Skous from Northern Confluence. We can't mine our way out of the climate crisis. So this should lead us to reflect about alternative pathways for a truly sustainable and just transition.